Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is The Conversation's Politics Podcast. Today, we're back talking with Cathy McGowan, the independent who unexpectedly seized the Victorian seat of Indi from the Liberals at the last election. Cathy McGowan ran on a platform of community engagement, and now, halfway through her first parliamentary term, she'll be back soon talking to the community about the coming budget. We speak about her plans for the next few months. Cathy McGowan, what sort of feedback are you getting at the moment from the community?
So there's a couple of levels to this. There's local and there's national. If I could start with the local, the big discussion in Indi with the media is what's going to happen in terms of running a candidate against me at the next election. So the Nats have been out there. They had their big national parliamentary meeting in Wodonga a couple of weeks ago. So a huge amount of interest in what the National Party are going to do. And the Liberals are also obviously interested in running in the seat. So that's been constant chatter in the media, what their plans are.
And well, just in terms of that, of course, you took this seat from Sophie Mirabella, who, if you hadn't won, it would now be in the cabinet. Is the word that Sophie will run again?
I think it's undecided. It's sort of bubbling along there. Regularly, Sophie's asked and she doesn't give a definite answer. There was also, so we don't know about that. I would think she's probably thinking about it. There was also quite a funny story a couple of weeks ago about Campbell Newman being invited to come down and run. So my sense is it's undecided. It's still all being talked about and no definite decisions have been made.
You don't expect to be up against Campbell Newman, do you?
No, I don't think so. No. So there's that part of it, but there's also the coalition arrangement. And there's been quite a lot of chat in the papers and certainly letters to the editors about what the relationship in Victoria is between the coalition. The National Party don't get a... Senator Bridget McKenzie is on the coalition ticket. She's up for re-election. And there's quite a bit of discussion around that coalition arrangement and how the preferences will flow in the Senate, and clearly how Indi's lined up will make a big difference on that. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about the coalition arrangement in Victoria and how that will play out in Indi. So that's at the local level where people are interested in national politics. But at the national level, people are really concerned about the government, the leadership and what's happening there. They desperately wanted it solved. One of the underpinning things of me getting elected was dissatisfaction with the Labor government and all the problems with leadership. And to see the Conservatives in exactly the same position, there's a level of real, I think almost annoyance about government in Canberra and get your act together and why can't you do this well? So certainly when I go out, there's a lot of support for me as an independent because I'm not aligned to either of the parties, and people see that I'm delivering and I'm getting on with the job of representing and I'm not involved in the party back and forward stuff. But there is certainly a very high level of discontent with the national scene as it's played out. The farmers, the business people, they've got a whole lot of issues and they really want government to get on with addressing the infrastructure needs that need to be solved and not to be involved in what they call sort of think it as self-indulgence. And I think it doesn't get explained really well to the community of how the leadership stuff is a really important part of national politics. People just get sick of it.
Do you think that they would like to see the Liberal Party change its leadership?
I don't think they really care, quite frankly. I think they just don't want to be bothered about Canberra's internal machinations. They want them to pick a leader and go with it. So I think that's really the majority of people think that. If I engage with people on a deeper level, people do have opinions for or against Tony Abbott. Some people think he's fantastic. They really like what he's done with stopping the boats and getting the government getting the free trade agreements through and lots of the things that the government has said it's going to do. They like that. The people more central of politics are not so pleased about it. And then as you move across the spectrum, the level of discontent with the government increases.
Do you think that things would settle down, however, if there was a change of leadership, or would there be more turmoil?
So it all depends, doesn't it? I think I would hope they would. But the lessons we learnt from Labor was when you had a deposed Prime Minister on the backbench, that went on for a long time. So when I do talk to people, they say, well, what would happen to Mr Abbott if we had the change? Would he go to the backbench like Rudd did? Would he be a destabilising influence? So I think people have watched what happened with the Labor government and are just worried that that same sort of game would play out and we would have another 2 years of not getting on and doing the job of government.
Do you find in the community that people have a lot of bread and butter concerns as opposed to this general disillusionment with politics and the way the government's going?
Look, I do, Michelle. When I go out and talk to my community, it's the things that they want to talk about are the things where government impacts on their lives. So, for example, telecommunications. Like three quarters of the phone calls into my office, and I would be getting, you know, over 100 a day, would be about NBN and no mobile phone coverage. Huge issue. The education debate. Just get it sorted out, make it fair for regional people, let us know what's happening so we can get on with our lives, particularly for rural people sending their kids to university, and the kids at university, how much do they have to pay? It's extraordinarily upsetting and stressful for families. The future of mental health. So what is the Commonwealth Government doing to actually address issues around mental health? We've been talking about it for a long time and then constantly getting stories of services not being coordinated and problems with that. Now, we're a bit lucky or blessed that we've got a headspace just opening in Wodonga that's come from a community work, but the level of need around mental health is enormous. The issue around aged care and aged care packages. So there was big reforms happened last year and they're now playing out. So communities are really anxious about, is the money going to flow to our smaller rural health services so we can deliver aged care in a good way to our communities?
Can we just take a couple of these? The telecommunications problems. Have you talked to Malcolm Turnbull about these and what's his response?
So I've got really good relationships with his office and also Paul Fletcher, who's a parliamentary secretary. And their response is good, like they can sort out individual problems, but the overriding need for a holistic approach to telecommunications is just not there for rural Australia. So, for example, Malcolm Turnbull, one of the problems we've got, if I could just explain it briefly, is we are getting NBN towers put up in some of the rural areas for broadband, and what our community wants is to be able to co-locate on that tower a mobile phone dish as well. So I asked a question of Malcolm Turnbull and he said, yes, absolutely, you should be able to co-locate. But the reality is NBN is a competitor with Telstra and they don't really want to work closely together. And at the local government level, when they're getting permits for it, it's really hard to get that level of cooperation. So I just absolutely calling on the government to make it really easy for co-location to happen, for community input. Like in some of our more isolated areas, the communities would give the land, we'd collect money and we could put up a tower ourselves. But it's very, very hard to do that because it's also wrapped up in regulation.
But can't the minister or the parliamentary secretary cut through here?
Well, absolutely. So they could if the will was there. But I have to say I don't actually see that political will for rural Australia. So we've certainly put these ideas up and got meetings to talk about it. But the passion and the need is not nearly strong enough.
What about the Nats? So obviously they're interested in this seat in the future, as you were mentioning. Are they willing to twist some arms?
I haven't seen it. And so I'm talking to the Nats about it and talking to my friends in the Mallee and saying, well, you must need this mobile phone coverage as much as we do. And they say, absolutely. So, but for some reason, the passion to represent regional Australia and to actually go in there with a force doesn't seem to be there.
Do you think the fact that your vote in the House doesn't affect the overall numbers is relevant here, that they can say, yes, yes, Cathy, we hear you, but they don't have to do anything about it?
It's certainly that's relevant. But in the Senate, we've got, say, two regional senators from two senators from Victoria who represent the regions. So Ricky Muir and John Madigan. So they know these issues just as much. Now, I just don't think there's a plan for regional Australia. I don't think we've actually been strong enough as communities to get our voices heard.
Do you work with those senators on absolutely, these sorts of issues?
Well, certainly we've been working on education. That's been the focus.
Well, let's talk about that. You recently had quite a significant forum in the electorate, which was, I think, organised by the regional universities.
Mm-hmm. By La Trobe and CSU, and me as the local member for both of those universities.
And what came through as messages from that meeting?
So there was two really interesting observations. One is that the vice-chancellors and the people who were involved in negotiation with the government were totally focused on working with the government to get the best result they could. So they weren't basically saying no. They were saying, well, how can we make this work? And they presented some very valid arguments of how they'd been able to get the government to move and get better results. The participants unanimously said no.
And the participants were what sort of people?
Community, businesses, big employers, students. So the people who need high quality regional universities, basically. So all aspects of that stakeholder group. And they said that there was almost nothing in the deregulation package that would benefit long-term sustainable training for regional communities. So they could see how it would work for the cities, but they, and even some of the negotiations that have been won, the concessions, like $100 million for regional universities as a structural adjustment payout, the audience said, well, that's per head of population, it's about, you know, nothing, and it's going to end in 4 years, and it's actually not going to give us, if the problem is market failure, a structural adjustment package that gets rid of it is not actually going to address long-term market failure. So the message that came back to me, and I've taken back to Minister Pine's office, is we actually need market mechanisms to ensure that if we are going to be able to compete, and this has always been the logic for regional Australia, where we need to compete with our city cousins, we need government to put in place market mechanisms to make a level playing field. So it's not about structural adjustments packages, and it's not about money to build accommodation. It's actually about what does the market need, so that the one example that I'll give you, Albury-Wodonga Health, which is our hospital, 70% of the jobs at that hospital need university qualifications. And we know that 24% of people who go away to universities come back. So we actually need in Albury-Wodonga, and that's just health, education's the same, town planning's the same, the lawyers are the same. If we're going to meet the market needs for qualified professionals in our regions, they need to be trained locally. And we need it's going to go on. It's not going to go away. We actually need a 50-year plan for how we're going to do it. Because if 70% now, as health gets more sophisticated, it's going to become about 80% of your health workers need university qualifications. And there's no – what the meeting actually said is this workforce planning and the role of the university's workforce providing professional people in regional areas hasn't been addressed.
So what sort of response are you getting from Christopher Pine's office?
So – well, very, very, very good access. The ministers and his staff saying, well, come up with the recommendations. You come up with what we need to do and we'll give very good thought to it. So certainly I've been working with the vice-chancellors to do that. But I'm sceptical. I think it's a bit of a dog's breakfast, and I don't think you can actually make it better. So my sense is much more that we let this one go and we really work together with Labor and the Greens and the relevant people and say, what do we need for a, if we need reform, we actually need a bipartisan approach to this.
So you think the package will be defeated in the Senate?
I do.
You don't think the numbers are there?
I don't think the numbers are there.
There's been a bit of talk about having a quite wide-ranging inquiry. I don't mean the current Senate inquiries. Would you favour that?
So when I put that to the vice-chancellors, they said, look, we know what needs to be done. We've done the inquiries. At the moment, it's a political problem. We need the politics to work out.
But mightn't an inquiry be one way of trying to finesse the politics?
So if the inquiry has bipartisan support, I think it's really useful. But the other thing that I can't understand, Michelle, is why we don't have the tried and true method of policy development, or an issues paper, a green paper, a white paper, moving into legislation. I think that's really what we need. And I can't see why it hasn't happened in this case, because that's a really good process. It allows people to contribute. You can get to work your way through the system. So ideally, that's what I'd like to see, the processes as we know them work. And I think that's what people are asking for, is good government processes and not this ad hoc election-driven response to things.
Now, you're going to now have some fairly intense budget consultations locally, is that right? What sort of budget do you think is needed for this second year of the parliamentary term?
So there's two things I'd like to say about the budget. One is that the last budget failed to deliver what I called a regional impact statement. So it wasn't just the budget that failed to do that, is the logic of the changes in the budget hadn't been costed out as to the impact on rural and regional Australia. So that budget landed very poorly in five particular ways. Sort of the co-payment added extra costs, the petrol added extra costs, the idea that young people would lose out on youth allowance had huge implications to regional Australia. So the first thing I'm asking of the government is to make sure that any changes that they are advocating have been put through some modelling process so that rural Australia is actually not further disadvantaged. And preferably we are advantaged so that the disadvantage we already experience is ameliorated. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, I'm absolutely calling on the government to think about infrastructure in regional Australia. The Prime Minister talked about being the infrastructure Prime Minister and the telecommunications money wasn't there. The public transport money wasn't there. The money for inland rail wasn't there. So these nation-building activities that we need for regional Australia weren't part of the budget. So my call is, if nothing else, can we put $1 billion into telecommunications and just sort out this mess with mobile phone and NBN and just get over the hump so that regional Australia can get on a par with their city cousins in terms of telecommunications? That alone would make a huge difference.
In your budget consultations, are you going to hold a series of meetings, or how will you do this?
There's two things that we've got underway. There's what we call the budget impact tour. So that's after the budget, to go out and talk to people about how they react to it. And leading up to it, but also running over it, we're running another series of what we call kitchen table conversations. So that specifically looks at issues.
This is pre-budget.
It's pre-budget, and also will run over the budget period as well. So that's bringing community together to say, what are the issues that we need to look at? What are the representational issues that people are talking about? And then the third thing, which is not just for here and now and this budget, but it's also for the next election, is what are the major areas that we need to work on as an electorate, that if we are going to have this hotly contested election campaign that might come sooner than the 3 years, then what are the issues that people, the policy issues that people want to put up, so that we have a policy election rather than a personality election.
Do you think that Joe Hockey is one of the listeners? Do you have any sense of engagement with him?
Pregnant pause, no. But his staff have been good. I must admit, following the last budget, we did go and speak with his staff about this budget, the impact of the budget on regional Australia. And so I hope they actually got the message that they need to do that work now. So if they are going to, in their ability to sell the budget message, it needs to have an understanding of regional Australia. The person who has got this is Warren Truss. He really does get regional Australia, and I think does do a good job for it. So I'm pinning my hopes on the National Party to do a much better job on this one.
Your relations with the National Party seem to be quite close, is that right?
So I'd say my relationships with all of the government are good. I've had excellent access. They've certainly given me opportunities to go and talk. So, you know, from Pine to Turnbull on all these topics that I'm talking about. So there was a lot of discussion when I got elected that the government would turn a blind eye and not do anything, and that's certainly not been the case. They've treated me with just great professionalism. So I think that my relationships with all of the government is really good. But of course, when it comes push comes to shove and they're wanting to win the seat back, I think that might be a different kettle of fish.
They might cool off a bit, you think. Can we end, Cathy McGowan, on a very specific issue? There's been, of course, a lot of controversy and angst over these imported berries and whether the quarantine and labelling and so on, laws should be or regulations should be changed. What do you feel about that?
So, absolutely agree. I was part of a House of Reps Standing Committee for Agriculture. We did a report last year on labelling and we made some excellent recommendations into that report, which is now before the government for acting. So at a minimalist, they could pick up the recommendations from their government's own committee to do something about that.
What was
that.
The thrust of those?
The thrust was we actually had to do a much better job at labelling where things come from and what percentage is made in Australia and what percentage is not. So that actually wasn't about the berries, but actually giving the consumer the information that for example, 70% of our bacon and cooked meat comes from overseas, but it's processed in Australia and it's made as, you know, made as if it's Australian. So that, I don't think that went nearly far enough, but it was the beginning of much more accurate labelling. So I just think it's a really big problem and it needs all the expertise we can bring to it.
And this has been a wake-up call. Do you think that the government will eventually have to respond to, or do you think it's all
I absolutely hope it's been a wake-up call. And I don't think the government can get away with just saying it's a one-off and, you know, it's only two factories or whatever the answer is. I think it's a significant problem, and I think absolutely know that consumers in Australia want to buy Australian and they want it clearly marked and they don't want it sort of fudged by, you know, manufacturing or whatever other language we use.
Cathy McGowan, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all for this Conversations Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll have another interview for you very soon.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.